From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. It's NFL regular season week XIII. Which teams will be playoff bound after week XVII and perhaps make it to Super Bowl XXXVIII? Ahead on Only a Game, the answers from Gridiron Guy, Paul Attner. Also an exploration of what makes Oklahoma better than just okay, and a conversation with hockey great Phil Esposito. Also ahead, the sports world comes together to encourage one of Only a Game's very own to pursue a lifelong dream.
Glad you're on track for the President's Physical Fitness Award. Remember that George Bush himself was a dissolute party boy as recently as 1986. Now he's signing the fitness certificate.
Stay tuned.
Run, Karen, run!
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Turkish authorities say they've arrested a man who may have ordered one of the deadly suicide bombings in Istanbul earlier this month. They did not identify him, but said he may have been behind the attack on the Beth Israel synagogue. That bombing, along with the bombings of another synagogue, the British consulate, and a British bank, killed more than 50 people and injured hundreds. Britain's minister for Northern Ireland is meeting with Northern Ireland's political parties. The talks follow the victory in elections to the local power-sharing government of hardliners opposed to the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. Miriam McGuire reports from Belfast.
The elections to the power-sharing government, the second ever to be held, have changed Northern Ireland's political landscape. The Democratic Unionist Party, a hardline pro-British party led by the Reverend Ian Paisley, has topped the poll. The party is fiercely opposed to the Good Friday peace accord, and its leaders refuse to sit with Sinn Féin ministers. In the Irish camp, Sinn Féin becomes the largest party. Its president, Gerry Adams, says all must be done to save the Good Friday accord. With such results, the future of the peace accord has been thrown into uncertainty. Fresh negotiations are expected after Christmas, but many doubt that the power-sharing government will be restored any time soon. For NPR News, I'm Marianne McGuire in Belfast.
A petition drive in Venezuela is underway that could lead to the recall of President Hugo Chavez. The first day, yesterday, was relatively peaceful. NPR's Martin Costi reports from Caracas.
The opposition needs to collect 2.4 million signatures by Monday in order to trigger a referendum to remove populist President Hugo Chavez, who was first elected in 1998. The lines of people waiting to sign the petitions are longest in middle and upper class neighborhoods, where people such as Veronica Alvarez were up at 7 a.m. to add their signatures. We have to sign this as soon as possible to demonstrate to the government that we're all focused on getting him out, Alvarez says. The opposition organized a similar petition a year ago, but electoral officials rejected it. This time around, the Organization of American States and other foreign groups are monitoring the petition. If the signatures are accepted, a recall election could be scheduled in the next 3 months. Martin Costi, NPR News, Caracas.
The Japanese space program suffered a setback today. Scientists had to blow up a rocket 10 minutes after liftoff when it malfunctioned and failed to reach orbit. The rocket was carrying two spy satellites designed to monitor North Korea, as well as provide information on natural disasters and weather patterns. Tokyo had launched its first two spy satellites in March, prompted by North Korea's test of a long-range missile over Japan's main island in 1998. This is NPR News. The holiday shopping season is officially underway. The National Retail Federation is predicting that sales will be 5.7% higher this year, for a total of more than $217 billion. Stocks rebounded from 2 weeks of losses this week as further evidence of economic strength continued to come in. Steve Beckner of Market News International reports.
Technology stocks led the way Friday in thin holiday trading after an upbeat report on semiconductor sales. Blue chips were little changed. For the week, the tech-heavy NASDAQ Composite Index rose 3.5%. The Dow Jones Industrials were up 1.6% to close just shy of 9,800. In the bond market, falling prices across the maturity spectrum pushed up yields. The yield on the benchmark 10-year Treasury note, to which many mortgage rates are tied, rose to over 4.3%. 3%, more than an eighth of a percent higher than a week earlier. Market interest rates rose partly because of upbeat economic news, such as a surge in durable goods orders and a Federal Reserve survey showing broad-based growth around the country, but also because the dollar fell against other major currencies. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
Police in Columbus, Ohio, are trying to determine if 11 shootings along a freeway are related. One person was hit and died. No one else was injured. The shootings began in May along a five-mile stretch of Interstate 270. The route runs through a sparsely populated area that includes woods frequented by hunters and people practicing target shooting. Police say the shots have been fired at different times of day, hitting trucks, cars, vans, and a horse trailer. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In the most recent Associated Press football coaches poll, Oklahoma got all 65 first-place votes. In short, the Sooners are the Tiger Woods of college football. Last weekend, Oklahoma hammered Big 12 conference opponent Texas Tech 56-25, but perhaps Texas Tech shouldn't feel so bad. While building the 12-0 record that has made it the nation's number one team, Oklahoma has been winning games by an average of 33 points. In losing by only 31, Texas Tech sort of won a moral victory, the only kind of victory anybody's been winning over Oklahoma this season. Earlier this week, I asked Jenny Carlson, who writes about college football for the Daily Oklahoman, if maybe Oklahoma should be required to spot each opponent a couple of touchdowns before the opening kickoff just for the sake of suspense.
I don't know. It might make them angry, and it might be even harder.
Obviously, Oklahoma's excellence has been no secret, but according to Sooners quarterback Jason White, neither he nor his mates nor their coach have been talking about the team's elite status.
Coach Stoops don't even really say anything about it to us because he knows we don't even talk about it. We go in every week just with the goal of winning on Saturday. And it's funny just because you think a number one team is going to talk about them being number one all the time, but our guys are always talking about, the next game.
The next game will pit Oklahoma against Kansas State a week from now for the Big 12 Conference Championship. Victory there will guarantee Oklahoma a trip to the national championship game in the Sugar Bowl, which Coach Stoops regards as the next brick in a tradition he's determined to continue building.
No one's going to pat us on the back if we don't finish out the year and win championships. So
right.
Those championship trophies in here aren't leaving. And we're after more of them, and that's what matters to us.
The odds are excellent that Oklahoma will get another of them in January. Not only that, this most recent ascension to the championship is likely to be a good deal more popular than were some of the triumphs of previous Oklahoma juggernauts. Some of those teams, coached by Bud Wilkerson and later Barry Switzer, were arrogant. Some of them were peppered with outlaws, according to both the NCAA and various police blotters. But according to columnist Jenny Carlson, this year's Sooners are different.
Those Sooners of the Switzer era had a bad reputation is because that they did some unsavory things. And so lots of these guys on this current team really deserve credit for staying out of trouble. There have been a few that have been picked up for some different things, but compared to those Switzer teams and even compared to other college football teams around the country, infractions, yes, but pretty minor in the grand scheme of things and in comparison to how it's been in the past.
Whatever football fans around the country may feel about the reemergence of Oklahoma as the top team in the country, fans in the neighborhood are thrilled. No matter that Coach Stoops and his players are taking it one game at a time, as the cliche has it, Jenny Carlson says that Oklahoma fans have already made their plans to be at the Sugar Bowl for the national championship game on January 4th.
pretty much all of the flights from Oklahoma City and surrounding areas to New Orleans on any airline, short of, I think, open-air cockpits, I think are booked for the early part of January.
Oklahoma is, as previously reported, off until a week from today, when the Sooners will meet Kansas State in the Big 12 Conference Championship game, a formality, say most of the experts, after which some unfortunate team will be sacrificed to Oklahoma in the national championship game, most likely the University of Southern California. Joining us now on the line to help us make sense of the NFL's waning regular season is Paul Attner of the Sporting News. Paul, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. Can you hold a minute? I've got Dionne Warwick on the other line here.
Okay. On Turkey Day, the playoff chances of Dallas and Green Bay were dimmed somewhat, but neither game was what you would exactly call a masterpiece. I wonder if the NFL ceased Turkey Day games altogether, would there be an outcry from sociopaths everywhere who'd be thrown back on the tender mercies of their families? Maybe the league should just do something to ensure we'd see better games on Thanksgiving.
I don't think there's any way to ever make sure there's better games, but I think you've hit it on right on the nose there. I think if they cut football off on Christmas, it'd be off a lot of male members of the species out there screaming and yelling that they couldn't get away from the table soon enough to be able to do something else other than be entertaining the relatives and the guests, neither one of which they probably want to do.
Kansas City, 10-1, and they'll play 2-9 San Diego tomorrow. The Chiefs are the current favorites, I guess, to go all the way. Are you among those who believes that'll happen?
No. I'm a guy that's never been on the Chiefs bandwagon all year. Not very beloved and embraced in Kansas City, but I just don't think they're that good. And I think they've done a wonderful job of winning games they shouldn't have won. And I think it's going to wind up that they're not going to even get to the Super Bowl, much less win the Super Bowl this year.
All right, so you're not a Kansas City fan for various arcane reasons. What is the best team in the league this year?
I think Tennessee's the best team. Case can be made for Kansas City. Case can be made for New England, for Indianapolis. But Steve McNair is my choice as the league's most valuable player. And because of that, I think that Tennessee now is the best team. And no one in the playoffs, Bill, is going to want to play Tennessee because of the brilliance of McNair.
Philadelphia started the season at a disappointing 2-3, but now they've won 6 in a row. Do the Eagles continue to fly high?
Well, I think they have a really test game on Sunday against the Carolina in Carolina. They get by that one, and I think any reasonable person would think they're the favorites in the NFC. But the problem with the NFC is there really are no good teams, Bill. And so even if the Eagles look like the hot team, I think that doesn't really mean that they're going to get to the Super Bowl either. At this point, and that's what Dan and I were talking about, we're not sure who is the best NFC team, and I'm trying to sort that out and probably need to get back to you maybe after the Super Bowl's over as to which one's the best.
Well, how did Dionne Warwick get involved in this? It has something to do with San Jose, I assume.
Well, we're psychics. You know, I mean, we've got to when in doubt, we have to go to different elements to figure this out. And that's why I had to start consulting tea leaves and Dionne Warwick and other such elements to try to figure this thing out.
I've heard a lot of speculation about the reasons for the recent woes of Tampa Bay. They range from Keyshawn Johnson's absence to the head coach to unfavorable trade winds, all sorts of things. So let me try a theory out on you, okay?
Sure.
The Bucs are 5-6 because they won the Super Bowl last time. How's that work for you?
You ought to become a football expert, Bill. I know.
What do you mean, become?
Well on your way to becoming that, but I talked to Ozzie Newsome recently, the general manager of the Ravens, and he said that people can never understand how difficult it is, especially in this era, to repeat as a Super Bowl champion. He said, everybody says that, and the cynics out there, of course, I'm not one of those, would shrug their shoulders and say, yeah, sure. But he said, first of all, you don't stop celebrating until about June, and by then everybody else in the league has already had mini camps and quarterback camps, whatever else they do, and so your Super Bowl champion automatically is behind. And he said, you really never catch up. And I think there is something to that, Bill, because you look at what's going on in the league the last 4 or 5 years, and no one's repeating, and usually those teams next year have terrible seasons.
Speaking of terrible seasons, speaking of lots of terrible seasons, the Cincinnati Bengals, not long ago the owners of the ignominious designation of, quote, worst pro sports team in American history, stand at 6-5. They're on top of their division, in playoff contention without any doubt, and they're printing playoff tickets in Cincinnati.
And God bless them. I mean, that city has been treated so shabbily by the owners of the Bengals, the relatives of Paul Brown, his sons and daughters that have forgotten how to win. And they finally went out and hired a coach, Marvin Lewis, in this past offseason, Bill, that he gets it. And to the Browns' credit, they've got out of the way. I mean, they handed over authority and power to Marvin Lewis that they never have given any head coach since 1990, which, by the way, was the last time they printed playoff tickets because they actually got in. And Marvin's done it. And they're just this is just the beginning, I think, with the Bengals. I think, you know, they may get into it this year. They may get in the playoffs this year. But I think from now on, you're going to see a very competitive franchise. And football actually has returned to Cincinnati, which leaves only Arizona as the one holdout in this league.
Paul, which games are particularly intriguing to you this this weekend?
Well, besides the Philadelphia at Carolina game, there's a great game involving the New England Patriots of all teams with the Colts. I mean, this is a huge game for the Patriots, who are one of the great stories in this league this year because of all the injuries they've had. And they've got a chance now, if they could beat the Colts, to probably establish themselves as the best team in the AFC. And then another intriguing game to me is Minnesota at St. Louis. Bill, in this attempt to sort out the NFC, St. Louis looms there as maybe the best team, but they need to beat the Vikings to make a case for themselves.
All right. Our next opportunity for some more of this good gridiron gab will probably be during the wild card weekend. So do you want to get us through the holiday season with a bold playoff prediction or two here?
Well, I think that, you know, you've need to a bold prediction. I think you need to watch, of all things, Tampa. I hate to think that they would get into the playoffs as badly as they've played, but I think you're seeing the collapse of the Minnesota Vikings potentially, and that could allow Tampa maybe to squeeze in. It's a long shot, but you heard it here first. And obviously you will never remind me of this prediction if it doesn't work out.
Obviously not.
And I think that Kansas City has a chance to build before this is over with the blow home field advantage in the AFC. And I think that very well could happen to them because there's so many other good teams right behind them. I think they will trip up a little bit and they could lose home field.
Paul Attner covers the NFL for the Sporting News, and he's our football guy here at Only a Game. Paul, thanks again.
Thank you, Bill.
You can take a closer look at this week's stories, peruse our archives, or sign up for our newsletter by visiting our website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Fans of a recent soccer match between Brazil and Peru were set for a special treat. Elcio Berti, the mayor of Bacaúva do Sul, the town in Brazil where the match was taking place, had promised that an alien spaceship would land during the match. Unhappily for thrill seekers and X-Files fans, he changed his mind. I canceled the landing because I was afraid that the aliens might abduct one of the Brazilian footballers, said Mr. Berti, who claims to be in regular touch with aliens and says they are helping to fund a UFO landing pad that he's building in town. Mayor Berti's previous claim to fame was banning all birth control devices in town in order to increase the number of pregnancies to boost federal funding.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's NHL action, the Bruins were the prey as the Predators of Nashville bested Boston 2-1. Philadelphia doubled up Carolina 4-2. San Jose edged Minnesota 2-1. Anaheim beat Chicago 4-3. Montreal vanquished Washington 5-3. Detroit blanked the New York Islanders 6-0. And the New York Rangers prevailed over Pittsburgh 4-1. Elsewhere, St. Louis tied Tampa Bay 2-2. Buffalo foiled Florida 4-3. Dallas shut out New Jersey 2-0. And Colorado clobbered Edmonton 4-1. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, young golfers teach their instructor a lesson. But first, on Monday, Florida Panthers defenseman Mathieu Biron slipped the biscuit past Buffalo Sabres goaltender Martin Biron, and in doing so, became the first NHL player in 23 years to score a goal against his brother. Phil Esposito of the New York Rangers also accomplished that feat, scoring on brother Tony of Chicago on November 5, 1980. Brother Tony is present in Phil Esposito's new book, Thunder and Lightning, a No BS Hockey Memoir, along with several remarkably frank observations. Esposito contends that lots of his teammates on the New York Rangers didn't care whether they won or lost. He also maintains that serving as a greeter for the Sands Hotel Casino in Atlantic City was the best job he ever had. Phil Esposito, late of the Chicago Blackhawks, the Boston Bruins, and the New York Rangers, has also been the general manager of the Tampa Bay Lightning. He serves as their radio color guy these days. Mr. Esposito joins me now in the studio. Phil, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Anybody who knows anything about the successful Bruins teams back in the 70s knows that you and your teammates had a wonderful time. I guess.
Yes, we did.
But until this book, maybe not just how good a time you had. Then there's the matter of how any of you managed to play hockey so well. What is the answer? Great constitutions?
Partly. I mean, sometimes, you know, you played better because of the guilt that you had the night before going out or something. I remember one time my brother Tony came into town. We had to play him the next night. And some of the guys said, why don't you take him out and see if you can get him to have a few beers and stuff, and maybe we'll beat him the next night. Well, I did. It was 4:30 or 5 in the morning when I dropped him off at the hotel, and he proceeded to shut us out 2-0 the next night. And they told me, never take him out again.
This is sort of the Babe Ruth theory. It never worked for him either.
I'm telling you, it was awful. I'd never take my brother out night before a game again.
Your recollections of your days with Bobby Orr and Derek Sanderson and the rest of those Bruins seem to suggest that you were awfully glad that you got to play hockey when you did, never mind that the money available to the great players these days is so much more.
Yeah.
Is that the case?
I think so. It was a perfect time for me. It was I had more luck than an ordinary guy should have. Because I played with Bobby Hull in Chicago for 3.5 years. And then I got to Boston and ended up playing with a guy like Bobby Orr. I mean, what better timing can one have?
Nice time to be standing in front of him.
Yeah, it was. And, I mean, before I got here, I was the feeder. I was the guy to get it to Bobby Hull. And when I got here, I became the scorer. And the other guys had to feed me. So, and that was Harry Sinden's responsibility. He was the one that saw it. He said, I think you could be the goal scorer here. So, I mean, and it turned out right.
In 1972, you played for Team Canada in a series against the Soviets. And you write in the book, they were commies, that's all I needed to know. Tell me about the motivation in that series.
Well, in the beginning, there wasn't anything because we thought it might be like an exhibition game or an all-star game where you go out and you have some fun and you know, nobody touches anybody or anything else. But after the first game, when they beat us 7-3, there was a shock factor set in. We trained for 2 weeks. They trained for 2 years. We found that out. And there was a huge shock factor. And that second game in Toronto was when I started to realize that this was not a game. It was becoming a war. And the war, it seemed to me that the propaganda, which was verified when we went to Russia, the propaganda was the society of the Soviet Union was better than the society of Canada via North America. And I said, well, I remember saying to some of the guys, the heck with them. We're going to prove them wrong if this is the way they want it. And it became a political thing without a doubt in my mind. For me, it did. And I've said this before, Bill, and I'll say it again as bluntly as I can. I often wonder how you can kill another person, you know, and shoot another person in a war or something like that. But I can tell you it scared the heck out of me. I probably would have killed them to win.
Wow.
Yeah.
Not a feeling you ever had on the ice at any other time.
Never before and never since. But and I felt for them. I liked them. But still, I would have killed them to win.
Phil, fans like to think that the players on their favorite team will always be going all out to win. And I gather that when you joined the Rangers after a trade that caught you completely by surprise, you didn't expect to be traded.
Right.
You were surprised to learn that wasn't the case in New York.
Well, once they were on the ice, they tried hard, I suppose. But I just didn't. That first game, I'll never forget it. It was in Oakland, and we lose 7-5 to the Oakland Seals, which really was the worst team in hockey. I got 2 goals and 2 assists that first game. And they scored, this one guy named Gary Sabourin scored 4 or 5 goals, maybe 3 from the blue line. And after the game, I was in the shower with Ron Gressner, and he seemed to be the only one that was kind of upset about it. Other guys came in, and they said, "What's your problem, Phil?" I says, "My problem? We just lost to the worst team in hockey, and nobody seems to give a damn. You guys," he said, "we got another one tomorrow night, so we got to wait. What's the difference? Can't get it back now." He's right. You can't go back, for sure. But I'm from the school where you got to not like to lose. If you get into a thing that you like to lose or it's okay to lose, then you're going to lose. That's just was the way I was. And Bobby Orr was worse, way worse than I was. If we lost a game, it was like, don't even talk to him for at least an hour and a half, okay? Oh, my Lord, he was terrible. But that's why he was so great.
And people are going to find this hard to believe. I mean, this sweet, baby-faced banker.
Yeah, well, he was a tough guy. He was a tough player. He played a lot, and he was, without a doubt, like the greatest.
You were also part owner of the Lightning, as well as the team's first general manager. Given the clouds gathering over the National Hockey League these days, are you glad that you no longer hold either of those positions?
Actually, I'm out there actually looking to try to get some investors again to do it again. I'd love to buy the Lightning back. There's no doubt about that, and I'm not making any secret about that. I don't know whether Mr. Davidson would even want to sell the team or not, but the truth of the matter is it's very difficult to get investors because they're all afraid of the collective bargaining agreement.
Sure.
But my theory to them, and a lot of these fellows I've talked to and these people I've talked to, are in real estate guys and make their money buying and selling real estate. And I say to them, "When do you try to buy your real estate?" And they said, "When it's at its lowest possible ebb." Well, I, for one, think hockey can never get any lower as far as the revenue base.
And people worrying about whether there'll even be a revenue base
exactly.
if the whole thing's suspended.
And what I think will happen is they may go out for 6 months, it might be a year that they are out, the players locked out. But when it comes back, there'll definitely be some sort of cost certainty or salary cap or whatever. Bettman uses the words cost certainty. Everybody else says salary cap. But there definitely will be that, and there'll be some sort of revenue sharing. There's got to be. And I would be surprised that if the players ever went on strike, I think would be the stupidest thing they ever did. Players make one, average salary is $1.8 million now. I mean, how much more do you want? Guys scoring 2 and 3 goals are making that. I don't dig it. I don't understand it. And there should be nobody in hockey, now that Gretzky's out of it, making $11 million.
Between various opportunities in the National Hockey League, you worked as a greeter at the Sands Hotel in Atlantic City.
Great job.
Do you think that sports fans will believe your contention in the book that greeter was the best job you ever had?
Well, let me put it this way. They paid me a lot of money. I went down there once a month in the summertime and maybe once every 3 months in the wintertime.
I'm beginning to understand.
And I went down on a weekend. On a Friday, they flew me down in a helicopter. I couldn't gamble, which was right up my alley because I didn't like gambling anyway. and except for on the golf course, and then I'm really bad at it. So I went and I met some tremendous, tremendous people, and I ate at the best restaurants. I drank the best wines. And guy, I remember this one guy, he took me to, he says, come with me, I want you to be my lucky piece. I went down and I watched him roll the dice for about 35 minutes. He might have been up about $150,000. And I says, I'm going back up, I'm going upstairs. I went back upstairs to this club that they had that was just for high rollers, and that's where I spent a lot of my time. And I went up there, and about 25, 30 minutes later, he came up there. And he says, where's that Esposito? Where is he? I said, I'm over here. He comes over. He says, you so-and-so, I can't believe you. Why'd you leave me? I said, what's your problem? He says, not only did I lose what I made, I lost another $100,000. And the next day, we're in a golf tournament together. True story. We're playing the scramble. Remember, you know what a scramble is. So this par five, I'm supposed to mark score. We have a par. I mark five. He comes over to me. And he says, what's this? I said, five. He said, no, we got three. I said, no, we didn't get three, and we got five. He says, I lost $150,000 last night. We got a three. I went, it's a three, baby. You got it. And you know what? He won a television set.
Which wasn't $150,000 TV set.
Think about that, you know? There's the idea of winning at all costs.
With the assistance of Peter Golenbach, Phil Esposito wrote Thunder and Lightning, a no-BS hockey memoir published by Triumph. Phil, thank you very much for joining me here at Only
Phil,
a Game.
Phil, thank you very, very much. This has been great.
When I was first given the opportunity to teach kids golf, I was, to say the least, very excited.
Charlie Schroeder is an actor and writer living in Los Angeles who never misses an opportunity to make a little pin money on the side.
I mean, what luck. A, I love golf, and B, I'd always secretly dreamed of being a teacher. Someone influential. And with this job, I could influence dozens. In fact, I was responsible for nearly 100 junior golfers, many of whom had never even touched a club. But it wouldn't take long for them to develop the sweet little swings that would earn them a mantle of trophies. In fact, I could almost hear little Billy proclaim in the not-too-distant future.
Well, I couldn't have won the Masters if it wasn't for Charlie.
Oh, man. Was I going to produce some great golfers or what? Okay, and that's how we grip the club. Now, without a good grip, you guys can never have a championship swing. So does anybody have any questions?
Ooh.
Yes, Alex.
Can I roll down the hill?
No.
Why not?
Because we're learning proper grip fundamentals. Now, is anybody confused about what interlocking means? Alex?
But I can do a somersault.
So can I.
My dad says I look like a roly-poly when I tumble.
Yeah, I'm sure you do, Steve.
Hey, guys, teacher wants to see me roll like a roly-poly.
No, I didn't say...
So we can all roll down the hill.
Hey, I thought I said...
Oh, no, there's grass in my shoe.
Okay, so my expectations were a little high. I was, after all, a little out of practice with eight-year-olds. I mean, the only one I'd interacted with in the past 10 years was...
Why, look! It's typical student Lisa Simpson.
Oh, hello. I've just been listening to Bach while reading at a sixth-grade level.
Lisa Simpson. All right. Today, we're going to work on the full swing. Steve, would you help demonstrate?
I'm hot.
Steve, it's very pleasant today. A perfect day to develop a fluid takeaway. Just like my most influential teachers, I strive to illuminate, not lecture. Now, I want you to address the ball, all right, and let the hands, arms, and shoulders begin the takeaway, working as one unit, kind of like the letter Y, rotating to the right. I imagined I was the legendary golf guru, Harvey Penick, guiding a young Ben Crenshaw.
Do I have to? I'm tired.
A very young Ben Crenshaw. Steve, do me a favor here, man. Turn your shoulders. But after trying several times to jumpstart their interest, Steve-man, the wisdom of Harvey Penick that I tried so hard to emulate, Duck Hook, turn your shoulders into the nasally bark of my high school gym teacher, Mr. McIntyre, a.k.a. Smack! Are you paying attention?
Yes.
What did I just say?
I don't know.
Something was seriously amiss. No matter what I did, no matter how specific I was or how many times I quoted verbatim from Ben Hogan's The Modern Fundamentals of Golf, the kids just couldn't get interested. In fact, if they weren't looking at me like I just swallowed the ball washer, they were asleep. Wake up!
This is boring.
Please,
I don't want to.
Oh, why can't we play baseball instead?
Do these shoes match?
I wanted to wrap my 5-iron around their puny little necks. Instead, I calmly, one might say psychotically, walked off the range and called it quits.
Serve the pizza? Throw the pizza.
Oh, God. One of the other instructors had some loud, corny drill about serving pizza. What the heck did pizza have to do with golf?
Throw the pizza.
Whoa.
Holy
shit.
Unbelievable.
Whoa. Her kids were ripping the ball. They were serving the pizza, a metaphor for the backswing, and throwing it, the downswing, over 100 yards. But, more importantly, her kids were totally into
it. Wait, I want to serve the pizza.
And so were mine.
Please?
They begged me to come back to the range.
Coach, teacher, teacher.
I hitched up my Sansa belts and took a deep breath. Well, so much for becoming a golf guru, I thought. What these kids need is a golf goofball. Okay, okay, okay. Who likes hot dogs?
I do. I like hot dogs.
Okay, okay, Andrew. All right, so when you grip the club, your left thumb is the hot dog, and the right palm is the bun. Now, you don't eat the hot dog outside the bun, do you?
No.
So place that hot dog in the bun.
Whoa.
Oh, not bad. Hey, not bad. Hey, everybody, listen up. I'm really, really proud of you guys, okay? You're well on your way to becoming the next Tiger Woods. And I thought, I'm well on my way to becoming the next Harvey Penick.
Whatever.
Tiger? The name is Tiger.
We named him Tiger. That's totally bogus.
Oh, I know.
Then again,
isn't he that kid going into eighth grade?
Maybe I'm not.
Like, Cheetah?
Charlie Schroeder is an actor and writer living in Los Angeles.
I must confess, I did not play my best. It was hard to concentrate with ketchup on my chest. But when I got back to the car, the kids were all asleep. Now I brought them home all safe and warm, so why are you mad at me? It was okay, honey, the kids were safe to be. They were locked up in the parking lot, I had the key. They had the cell phone, they could call me anytime. And I didn't break my promise, I got back here by 9. Now it was all right, honey, the kids were in the car.
You're listening to Only a Game.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company, with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment. On the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan & Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Cub fans dance on Waveland Avenue.
Reverse the curse, rally foul.
The Bulls basketball dynasty begins with a shot.
Here's Michael at the foul line. A shot on Elo. Goal! The Bulls win!
Can't come up with anything for the Blackhawks or White Sox at the moment. I'm Scott Simon. Tune in for Chicago sports and maybe sports from beyond. And, oh, right, we almost forgot the news on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Bob Z with these sports headlines. In yesterday's NBA action, Boston bettered the Bucks of Milwaukee 106-96. Toronto edged Orlando 87-86. Indiana flummoxed Philadelphia 90-77. Denver downed Dallas 113-103. Golden State beat Phoenix 92-83. Portland negated New Jersey 97-93. And Atlanta triumphed over Miami 95-83. Elsewhere, Detroit beat Cleveland 92-88. Memphis deferred to Minnesota. The score was 102-98 in that game. Utah stopped Seattle 98-81. Sacramento beat Houston 103-74. And the Lakers stymied the Spurs 103-87. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Karen Givens strives for presidential approval, and politics have nothing to do with her effort. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me by phone from Ithaca, New York, for our discussion of the week's sports events. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Curt Schilling is now a member of the Boston Red Sox. On Friday, the former Arizona Diamondbacks co-ace joined a pitching rotation that includes Pedro Martinez and Derek Lowe. So, will the alleged ghosts of 1918 be exorcised as a result?
What do you want in the rotator cuff pool? I'll take June 23rd.
Spoken like a Red Sox fan.
No, this is a good pickup for them. Now, if they can add Keith Foulkes, the closer, to Curt Schilling, then they have put themselves in the position to be the preseason, I think, close to odds on favorite to win the American League. And boy, am I going to regret having said that on tape.
Charlie, on Monday, Warren Spahn died. No left-handed pitcher won more games than Spahn's 363 victories. And my guess is that you can perhaps suggest other reasons to celebrate his career.
Yeah, I think that, he is somebody I actually met, although after his pitching career, and I do remember the annual Jimmy Fund game at Fenway, where the Milwaukee Boston Braves would come back and play an exhibition game in Fenway Park, and it always seemed Warren Spahn was pitching in that game.
Alonzo Mourning officially retired this week. The kidney disease, which had previously interrupted his career, has now ended it. Now calls are streaming in from potential donors who specifically mention they want Mourning to have their kidney. One of the perks of celebrity, I suppose.
I guess, but this is one of those stories where when you start out to be a sports writer, you never think you'll be covering the certain issues. This is one of those issues you didn't think you're going to be covering. This is. A strange mixture of really kind of creepy fandom and kind of laudable charity. I'm not exactly sure where I come down on this.
On Wednesday, Texas Christian University announced that it's planning to decline an invitation to the December 18th GMAC Bowl because that bowl falls right in the middle of the school's exam period. Why would a little schedule conflict like that stop any self-respecting football program?
All right, everybody in the audience who came to work today on a turnip truck, please raise your hands. if Texas Christian University had stayed undefeated and been selected for one of the big money BCS games, they would have practiced right through exam period. They would have been caught up in the hoopla right through exam period. The only thing they wouldn't have done during the exam period is actually play the game. This is about not making the bowl game you wanted to make.
On Tuesday, U.S. Track and Field announced this year's inductees into the National Track and Field Hall of Fame. Mary Decker Slaney was among them, as was sprinter John Carlos, best known, I'm sure, for raising a black-gloved fist on the medal stand at the 68 Olympics. This is kind of like a formerly blacklisted screenwriter winning an Oscar, isn't it?
It's exactly what it is. It proves there are a lot of grumpy old white men who aren't involved in track and field that once were. Tommy Smith, the other American in that memorable photo, the third one being Peter Norman, the Australian, who you may recall finished second, beat Carlos at the tape.
Mm-hmm.
John Carlos finished third in that race. Tommy Smith won it to the Hall of Fame in 1978, this is the final kind of nice bit of closure on what I still think is one of the single most dignified and moving demonstrations I've ever seen in any venue, let alone sports.
The San Antonio Spurs recently presented a 2003 NBA championship ring to Patrick Flores, who will retire next summer after a 24-year career as San Antonio's Archbishop and Spurs Arch-Rooter. I mean, Tim Duncan helps a lot, but I had no idea the team was stacking the deck with this kind of backup.
Now, look, I'm sitting here now as, like, Catholic guy, okay?
Uh-huh.
Doesn't the Archbishop already have a ring?
And a scepter, all kinds of stuff.
And which one do you kiss now? Do you kiss, like, the Episcopal ring or the NBA championship ring?
I guess it depends on who you root for.
I guess so.
Finally, Charlie, the NFL ruled this week that Kansas City Chiefs kicker Morton Anderson may not accept a $500 bottle of Cabernet that Chiefs head coach Dick Vermeil offered to him for kicking the game-winning field goal against Oakland last weekend. It's an illegal performance bonus, says the league. So justice served, right?
Well, hopefully justice served that night at the Anderson dinner table. I figure anything you consume on the spot is within the rules. And if Mr. Anderson has the brains of a veteran football player, he's handing the league back an empty bottle.
Charlie Pierce, who writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine, joins me each week and has never, ever whined during our conversation, though I believe he perhaps has dined from time to time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Why is Booty Udy drinking wine? Why is Booty Udy drinking wine? Slip that bottle to me, yeah, Lord.
Some athletes go years, even decades, before fulfilling their dreams. One recent example is Ray Bourque, who went without a Stanley Cup for 22 seasons, then took home the hardware in the game that ended his brilliant 23-year NHL career. But here's an even more recent example, furnished courtesy of Only a Game's Karen Given.
It was a windy spring day in 1983 when I first took the presidential physical fitness test. Our fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Killam, said that if we passed, we'd receive a certificate signed by President Reagan himself. Well, I thought, I've aced every test I've taken in my life, and today will be no different. The real trouble came with a flexed arm hang. To earn the award, I would need to hold a stationary chin-up for more than 20 seconds. A teacher lifted me up to the cold metal bar, but as he released his hold, I fell to the ground. My time, 0.0 seconds. No award, no presidential autograph. But 20 years after my debacle, Lynn Swann, Hall of Fame wide receiver for the Pittsburgh Steelers and current chairman of the President's Council on Physical Fitness and Sports, announced that the President's Active Lifestyle Award would soon be offered to adults.
When this was initially brought forth in 1956 by President Eisenhower, adults were in pretty good shape. We had a very active lifestyle for adults in America. Now we have about 64% of adults in America who do not work out. There are about 300,000 people a year who will die because of obesity or obesity-related illnesses and diseases. I don't want to be one of them.
The Active Lifestyle Program encourages kids, adults, and even seniors to work out and offers awards at different levels. Participants choose from a list of almost 100 activities, everything from aerobics to bowling, running, and something called volleyball. 30 minutes of exercise 5 days a week for 6 weeks, and a certificate signed by President Bush will be mine. This time, I will not be denied. But first, I need a little advice. At 51 years old, Lynn Swann still does 45 minutes of cardio and a minimum of 300 sit-ups a day, so I'm sure he can get me motivated. Now, I'm going to go running tonight, so I know I'm going to get out there, and after about 10 minutes, I'm really going to want to stop.
Why?
Because it's going to hurt.
Why is it going to hurt?
Because I'm not very... I haven't run for longer than 10 minutes at a time for years.
Okay, so why don't you go out and run 10 minutes, and then walk, and then see if you can run for another 10 minutes. You don't have to do it all at once. The idea is that if you're out there for 30 minutes running and walking, you're getting in the 30 minutes of physical activity you want to get in.
By the time my husband Mark and I set out for our first run later that day, I'm not completely convinced.
You want to know what Lynn Swann said to me today?
What?
He told me I should work out so that I don't die. You want to work out because you don't want to die.
Is that motivating?
Well, I'm going to die eventually anyway, right?
No, you're just going to hard enough, apparently.
Apparently.
Maybe I shouldn't be surprised that my first run is less than awe-inspiring. My dog, Zach, pulls at his leash, desperate to stretch his legs. I pace myself at a speed just barely faster than a walk. After 13 minutes, my chest is heaving. No matter how hard I try, I can't seem to get enough breath, and I have to slow down to a walk. Over the next few days and weeks, it gets better. Still, every time I step outside my front door for a run, all I want to do is turn around and go home. And every time I ask for advice on how to stay motivated, I get the same answer, like this one from pro basketball player and fitness expert Jennifer Azey.
If it's so hard that you want to turn around and quit and go back home, then you're probably actually going a little bit harder than you should.
Let's be clear. My problem has never been overtraining. My problem is that I want to stop working out before I've even begun. So I asked Jen what she does when she's feeling lazy.
I generally don't get that way. I mean, you know, for the most part, if I'm out there and I'm doing it, chances are I have to tell myself sometimes to take easier days. But, you know, as far as being lazy, that's a hard one for me.
Not much help there. And after running circles in my neighborhood for a few weeks, I'm not only lazy, I'm bored. So I head to the gym for some variety and inspiration.
Okay. All right, so we're going to start on the board.
At HealthWorks, the women's only gym near the Only a Game studios, instructor Maria Vishon offers both.
Physically and mentally, you're going to feel better. You're going to look better. You're going to be stronger. You're going to have more energy. You're going to want to keep coming back and doing it, and that's going to keep you going and going and going. Putting aside the fact that it's going to lengthen your lifespan and it's going to increase your cardiovascular ability and it's going to make your heart stronger and your muscles stronger, and as a woman, it's going to make your bones stronger, which is very important for osteoporosis. I mean, if those aren't reasons enough to motivate you to keep going, I don't know what is.
Stay down. Run it. Cut it up. Boys, chest is up.
In between gasps, I can't help but notice that nearly everyone in this gym is really, really fit. And even though it's probably all in my head, I can't shake the feeling that I'm being watched and judged. After class, I begin to wonder, is there anyone here who's ever been out of shape? I decide to ask at the trainer's desk.
Have you always been fit?
As a dancer, yes. I started dancing when I was 3 years old, so fitness has always been, you know, a component of my life.
Have you always been fit?
Pretty much. Through, like, high school and stuff, I was very active, so I was always playing basketball, track, danced a lot.
That's it. I need to talk to someone who knows what it's like to start from scratch. Someone who has hips and thighs. You know, someone more like me.
Joshua Tree Recreation, Michelle speaking.
Hi, Mom.
Hi.
My mom, Michelle Given, started doing jazzercise when I was a kid. By the time I was studying for my SATs, she was studying for her aerobics instructor certification. It must have been intimidating for her to take classes with younger, fitter instructors in training, but she didn't worry about that.
Well, that's it. You just accept yourself for the way you are, and you do the best with what you have. And sure, it would be wonderful to look like that, but people like coming to my class because it was a non-intimidating class. They came in, and they took one look at me and thought, she can do it, I can do it too. We supported one another and knew that we would never maybe look like a dancer, but we could feel like one.
I decided to try out my mom's theory and visit a class at the Baron Baptiste Power Yoga Institute, taught by Rhea Schlichter, a former dancer.
And into the space, we sing 3 ohms together. Take a breath in.
After the first 5 minutes in a 90-degree room, I'm covered in sweat and can't wait for the class to be over. Soon, I'm too focused on my own practice to worry about whether the other students are watching me. At the end, during Shavasana or relaxation, there's nowhere I'd rather be.
How are you feeling right now?
Great.
That's why. And you get energized, too. Do you feel like it? I mean, you are. You're kind of like shining. You're like radiating before my eyes. And everything just keeps, you know, going. It's like a forward motion. Just gets better and better.
As it turns out, Rhea's right. By week four, I'm fully hooked on exercise. I finally give in and join the gym because it's getting too cold to run outdoors. My first day on the treadmill feels pretty good, and by now, the word has gotten out that I'm taking the president's challenge, and some much-appreciated encouragement has started to stream in.
Hi, Taryn. It's Peter Moore calling from Men's Health Magazine. Glad you're on track for the President's Physical Fitness Award. Remember that George Bush himself was a dissolute party boy as recently as 1986, and he broke for daylight while jogging. Now he's signing the fitness certificates. So get out the door and go for it. Taryn Given for Healthy Person in 2003 and for President in 2020. Run, Taryn, run!
And I run. Maybe not quite as gracefully as some of the runners I see on the street, but I no longer feel completely ridiculous. For the first time, I'm not worried about whether I'll be able to finish this challenge. I'm too busy scheduling my fitness plan for after that long-awaited certificate is in my hands. Amy Checo Sedgwick, an avid runner and fourth-year University of Vermont medical student, isn't surprised by the transformation.
People in general get so frustrated with that, you know, building up period, and they're almost there, and they just don't get over that hump. And it's like things on the other side of that hump are so beautiful, and it's such a great synergy with mental health and your physical health and happiness and all these things that can be emphasized by exercise.
Last Tuesday, more than 20 years after my first attempt, I earned a Presidential Fitness Award. I've already figured out where to hang my certificate with George Bush's John Hancock. It's going right next to this month's class schedule for the gym. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
You know, the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah. We chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there. But can you still recall the time we cried? Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from Greg Eklund. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter, get hip to Karen's fitness tips, or join a group of our listeners determined to get in shape and stay there, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from aerobics instructor Michelle Given, who pledges perpetual moral support to her daughter Karen.
Well, if you need any more, you know where to reach me. I'll just talk about exercise all day long. It's my favorite subject.
Well, Ms. Given, it sounds to me like you've got a job waiting for you at Men's Health Magazine. Get Peter Moore on the line, will you please? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.